Hello, and welcome to the Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are strategist and former political director of the AFL-CIO, Michael Pothorzer, and the author of The Barn, The Secret History of a Murder in Mississippi, Wright Thompson. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to at Politicon for next week's show. Now we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Before we get started, get out your calendars. We have more exciting news. James and I are taking Politics War Room on tour. Come see us live in Atlanta on October 12th at the Variety Playhouse or at Boston's Schubert Theater on November 2. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we really can't wait to see you there. Get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com, and please tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, Quince, and Smalls. We thank you for supporting our sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. We've all heard that the devil went down to Georgia. You know, these days most people call him Trump. But it's a beautiful state with great people. So James and I are heading there to make sure it goes blue in November, and we want you there. In just 3 weeks, we're taking Politics War Room on the road to Atlanta for a live show on October 12th at the Variety Playhouse. What do you think the audience should expect, James?
Well, what I hope that we deliver, what we try to, is some insight politics, some jokes. We'll have some interaction with the audience. What I'm expecting there is a good time. So if you want to come and see if we meet the expectations, but my intent is the state of my birth. I got a lot of friends there, and there's a lot of stuff that we can talk about, and I'm going to have fun, and I think everybody else will.
And there may still be people there who remember my wife, who for 5 years was an anchor on a local Atlanta television station, started her career covering a peanut farmer named Jimmy Carter, who is about to have his 100th birthday, by the way. And he has told people that, the 100th birthday is big, but the main thing I care about is getting cast my mail-in vote before November 5. So it is a beautiful state, and it's an incredibly important state. So I'm really looking forward to getting our listeners fired up for a big win. I think Georgia not only is in play, I think, if it's an honest election down there and the Republicans don't cheat, I think that Harris Walz can win Georgia, James.
Let's do it again in 2024. But, we'll get fired up at the event in Atlanta and we'll go forth from there.
Yeah. It'll be an incredible show, and it's a perfect way to kick off the election's final stretch. All you have to do is go to politicon.com/tour and get your tickets for October 12th at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, Georgia. Help us bring the vibes that will put Kamala in the Oval Office. And no, don't wait. They're going fast, and we want to see as many of you there as we can. So head to politicon.com/tour. That's politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. The road to the White House starts then. We'll see you there. Hey, James, our guest, Michael Pothorzer, a former political director for the AFL-CIO and one of the most astute, that's no hyperbole, analyst of American politics. Michael, less than 50 days out, how do you see this presidential race today and any dynamics that are likely to really change it in the next 7 weeks?
Sure. And first, thank you for having me on. That's very generous of you to say. I've respected your journalism and James's strategic insights for like decades. We're really kind of up there in age, all of us. The To me, the dynamics of the election are really not that different from what we learned in November 2016, right? It has been the same five or six states that are going to determine this in the Electoral College. They are all almost dead even. And the difference between how well Biden did in 2020 and how well Hillary Clinton did in 2016 and how well Democrats did in those same states in 2022 is really about a big new set of voters who came out because of their concerns of all the things that they are injured by Trump and MAGA, right? That for most people, unfortunately, there's not really a background understanding that for basically all of our three political lives, which is pretty long, the turnout rates in this country have been remarkably steady. And after Trump won, they have shot up to ahistorical proportions because there's a set of people who, in a sense, never realized anyone would go as far as Trump, and these people started voting. But even more people realized that even though they were alienated from the political process, they had too much to lose if he got a second term or if Kerry Lake became governor or that. So fast forward to 24, it's the same states that are going to decide it, and it's the same dynamic. We saw when Harris got the nomination, her doing an incredibly good job of reclaiming all of the Democrats who had become demoralized by their choices before that. That only gets us so far. The next part is making sure it'll be determined really in the next month about whether in the last 2 weeks, we are talking about national abortion bans, about all the other things that threaten average Americans, or we're talking about immigration or the Biden economic record or something like that. If it's the former, then, you know, for the fifth time, a national majority will reject Trump and MAGA.
Michael, I've talked to a couple of Republicans who they think they're behind. They think Trump is behind right now, but they say there are two critical offsets that Trump invariably, they say, overperforms his polls, turning out more low propensity voters, and that the Republicans enjoy an electoral college advantage. The Democrats have to win by at least 2 or 3 points to get to 270 electoral votes. Do you think both of those are still true?
Well, I think that to start with the second point about the electoral college advantage, I think that the electoral college penalty as an idea first arose as a after election way of saying just how undemocratic having an electoral college is. But there's no fixed relationship between the national vote and the vote in Wisconsin, right? And so Harris could eliminate the Electoral College penalty by doing worse in California.
Right, right, right.
And that really, like, is not an advantage. The proper way to think about it is, like, the most direct way, is she winning in Wisconsin? Not is she winning by enough nationally so that this like electoral penalty god doesn't come in and make her lose, right? And that's really what we have to focus on. And I think the polling is consistently misleading and in both directions because the way the polling's done ignores the most important piece of information we have right now. And this is very different from like when James was doing 1992 or any of these other times. This is going to be the fifth time people are voting with the same question. And almost all of them don't change their minds, right? But when you start polling, you introduce all the statistical uncertainty that makes it look like everything's more volatile and fluid than it really is, right? There are about 174 million people in America who have already voted in the last four elections, and 91 million of them have voted for Biden or Democrats, right? Harris wins if they come back and do it again. And ignoring that by pretending that we don't already know how almost everybody's going to vote in 2 months is going to vote, like, creates this uncertainty. So I would not pay attention to the polls at this point.
The national polls. Now, would you pay attention?
Yeah, or the state polls. Even, right. Because it's still, remember that in Wisconsin, Trump won by 20,000 in 2016 and Biden won by 20,000 in 2020.
Right.
Even the polls the day before the last 538 forecasts and polling averages got, you know, a bunch of the states wrong in 16, 20, and 22, right? And polling just is like applying sort of a magnifying glass to a problem you need a microscope for. And so that's the problem.
Michael, you mentioned that it would be your hope the focus is on abortion. Also, do you think Project 2025, which Trump pretends like he knows nothing about, even though he and Vance's fingerprints are all over it, is that an issue that resonates with voters?
Right. So I think that I was using abortion both narrowly and more broadly. I think the Project 2025 as a label, I don't see evidence that that is really landing. Pulling out the specific things that are in it that matter to individuals, that's what lands. Right. And so if people believe that the things that will affect them are actually going to happen if he wins, that's when they come out.
So Michael, in 2020, there were right at 160 million votes cast, I think, which was...
You broke up. I'm sorry.
I said in 2020, there was about 160 million votes cast in the presidential election, maybe a little bit under, but rounding up. Did you expect that number to go up, down, or stay the same?
I think that it's going to be ballpark, but it really depends on what I was just saying about how concerned voters are about the real consequences of a second Trump administration. The higher the concern, the higher the turnout's going to be.
So it's no secret since President Obama ran, Democrats have kind of underperformed with black turnout. And a lot of people have tried a lot of different things, but we're not getting the contribution. And, you know, of course, it was looking bad. And Harris, do you think that black turnout... does it worry you if you look at it from the vantage point of the Democrats, or you think it'll line up pretty well at the end of the day? Or where are we in this? Because it's really important constituency in the party.
I think you're putting your finger on something that's very, very important and that I don't have a crystal ball for. I think part of it, though, I think is that we have to, you know, understand that for obvious reasons, turnout when Obama was running was going to be much higher. And thinking about that as a baseline against which Democrats are not doing as well is unrealistic, I think, right? That was like an obvious, especially for older generations, like you are not going to keep them from voting. And I think that after he left office, many of the folks who hadn't been voting before 2008 went back to not voting. And so I think that's part of it. And then I think that out in the red states, the intense voter suppression laws that have been passed have had a meaningful impact on depressing black turnout in that region. In 2008, the turnout rate in blue and red states was basically the same. Since then, it's held its own pretty much in blue states, and it's gone down in red states. All of those things are working. But it's absolutely clear that turnout has to improve in Milwaukee and Philadelphia, Detroit, and so forth.
So before I turn it back, I got to say one story. I came on television and said, put away the Ambien and the razor blades. We're going to be fine. I didn't give credit to the person who gave me confidence to say that. It was you. Somebody texted me and Michael just said, I've seen enough. I'm going to bed. I've seen this movie before. And then I knew he was okay. That's the effect of Michael's word. I mean, if you...
Well, thank you.
You might know who Nate Silva is. You might know who different people are. But if you're in Washington and you follow this, Michael is the first name you know for sure.
Well, thank you.
Michael, let me pick up the, I guess it's the reverse of the black vote that you spoke about a minute ago, and that's non-college educated white working class voters that have gravitated away from the Democrats in recent decades. What should the message or approach of Harris Walz or even, you know, congressional candidates like Bob Casey, what should they be saying, doing, proposing? Maybe not to win those that vote, but at least pare back the margins.
Sure, I think so. I'm going to test this with James, who's actually run a national presidential campaign. But the thing that is strange to me is the way we put this intermediate step in of how what you just said of how do we win more white non-college, right? As someone who's run big campaigns too, but also thought about it, the first layer is how do I get everybody who agrees with me? And you don't get bonus points for them being white non-college, and you don't lose points. I mean, every vote's a vote, right? And so what you're looking for is the majority in Wisconsin, right? And the way to think about the majority in Wisconsin is in terms of the things that people are really concerned about Trump and the things that people are like Harris for, right? And that guides what you should be doing, right? And there's a misunderstanding of just how much demographics explain vote, right? A white non-college voter in a blue state voted for Biden more than a white college voter did in red states, right? It only goes so far to explaining it. And that's, I think, something that shouldn't let distract us.
Michael, I know there's only so many priorities you can have. You can't underline every page. And talking about the issues that you think are important for Democrats to stress, you mentioned abortion. You mentioned the particulars of Project 2025. I don't know. I think Obamacare with subsidies due to expire next year should be a winning issue. And I think lower drug prices, insulin and others, should be a winning issue. And even tax cuts for the rich. Now, I got a whole basket full of issues now, and you have to prioritize. But are those, I mean, how does that strike you?
I think the first two I completely agree with, because in both instances, the issue is about taking something away from you. The third, I think, is much less motivating. Because it doesn't really mean you're going to lose something. At least that's the way most people think about it, right? What is important in thinking, anybody who, you know, thinks about issues and is going to trust either Harris's word or Trump's has almost certainly already decided who they're going to vote for. Right now, the battle is over whether people who are not habitual voters show up. And the possibility of losing like the insulin, if that's relevant to you, is going to get you to the polls, right? The possibility of losing your Obamacare or even worse, pre-existing conditions is going to get you to the polls. Being sort of told about tax cuts is not, you're just going to stay home.
So Michael, you get a phone call. It's Doug Emhoff, the vice presidential nominee's husband. And he says, I stepped out of a meeting. I got to have an answer in 30 seconds. We got $50 million. We can put it in either Florida or Texas. Where would you put it?
Wisconsin.
No. I got 50 million. I can go either way.
And I would do that for his mental health, because if he wakes up on November 6th and Harris is, 10,000 votes short in one of the states we already know is going to decide the election, right? That's not going to look like a smart play. And I think with so much at stake in this election, I think that we just have to win those states. If we win those states, we win the White House, we win the House, and we've gone through how many cycles where suddenly Jamie Harrison is in play in South Carolina or whatever, and we just are cats and a laser pointer and forget the stuff we have to do to get across the finish line.
So you're a big believer in the big three plus Omaha congressional.
Yeah, well, the six of them. The other thing that's important is that it's getting to 270, a lot, just stopping at 270 is really dangerous for Harrison.
Okay.
Right, because one of the things people don't appreciate about how we got through 2020 in the post-election was that she had three states to spare. And what that meant is that when, say, Trump called Raffensperger and said, fine, 11,780 votes, he's smart. He knew that if two blue state secretaries of state didn't flip their states, he just committed a felony. Biden's president, DOJ's coming after him. But I'm not so confident he'd have done that if all it would have taken to make Trump president again was finding those votes. And I think really it's important to get past 270.
Before I'll let you go, you back. You wrote very passionately about Roberts in the Supreme Court. And tell us what really pissed you off about the whole thing, because it took you out of your electoral comfort zone and put you on the Supreme Court. And I know something irritated the shit out of you.
Well, I think the thing is that you know how all worked up we all were when Trump said, don't worry, I'm just going to be dictator for a day, right? Somehow we've let it past us that Roberts has been dictator for 18 years, right? That he has changed the way we do elections by letting billionaires spend as much money as they want. He's changed it by undoing the Voting Rights Act. He's all of these things, the gerrymandering, all of these things that never could have happened if it had to go through Congress, he did by fiat. And we didn't react the way we should have. And what I was writing about was that finally, in that New York Times story Sunday, it really ripped the veil off that he was never a good faith umpire, right? He has always been an umpire who decides what the final score is going to be before the players take the field. And our hope for the future is making sure that we realize how they have actually implemented something like a constitutional coup in this country. And that in any other country in the world, if we had heard that they had a president who tried an insurrection and then was prosecuted for it, but was given immunity by three judges that he had appointed. And we would not look for the historical legal traditions in the country to know exactly what's up. So yes, and you're already kind of working me back up. But I think if we don't understand how much we're looking in the wrong place for these last 20 years, that's a big problem.
Great.
Thank you. You keep talking about the big six. Roy Cooper told us in Chicago, we're going to win North Carolina. So would you add that? Would you say the big seven?
I'm not saying that we won't or that we can't, but that we haven't, and we need to do everything we can where we already have more people who have voted against them than have voted for them. It's just a harder task there. And I'm not trying to diss his assessment of it. I'm just saying that if you have to make tough choices And you have states where we have, this is another one of those things. If you remember how we all felt in November 2016 about the blue wall crumbling and the sense of white non-college voters, oh my God, Democrats are doomed for eternity now. Since then, there have been 27 elections in the five states that Biden flipped. And MAGA has lost 23 of them, right? They, other than Kemp twice, really, we've like run the table in those states. That's, we know how to do that. And so I'm not like doing crystal ball on North Carolina. I just know what we have to do to have Kamala Harris sworn in January.
Michael, you are everything we said you were. And based on what you told James, I hope you go to bed early on November 5th.
I hope so.
Thank you very much.
I'll be waiting for the word, dude. I'll be waiting for the word.
Thank you, Jim.
Text me when you see it. Okay.
Wright Thompson, a celebrated writer, has written a new book, The Barn, The Secret History of a Mississippi Murder, that of Emmett Till almost 70 years ago. Wright, you are a renowned sports writer, a great storyteller. What got you into writing about The Barn and Emmett Till?
You know, I was at home during the pandemic and was talking to a friend of mine who asked if I'd ever heard of The Barn. And I said, what barn? And he started telling me the story. And one, I guess two obsessions sort of drove the quest. And, you know, and this is, these are things that, you know, James and I have talked about for a long time as Southerners. You know, one was, how could this have possibly happened? And two, how could I have not known about it? And, you know, I think one of the central conflicts in the modern South is the that feels very prescient so close to November is the eternal battle between memory and erasure. And, you know, it felt to me like if you don't know the truth about where you're from, you're not really from anywhere. And if you're not really from anywhere, then you don't really exist. And it felt like that was the animating quest through all of this.
Well, just the context, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy from Chicago visiting relatives in Mississippi, and a white woman charged falsely, apparently, that he had whistled or made a play for her or something in a grocery store. Her husband and one other man, we thought back then, although I think you've elaborated on that, went and took this kid to this barn and brutally murdered him. You have said and written that the whole story has never come out, and it wasn't just two men. There were a whole bunch of them.
So, you know, there were, as best as I can come up with, eight. And it was many people from the same family. I mean, I think two things. I think one, it's important to know that it wasn't just a group of people killing a child. It was one tribe of people killing a member of another tribe of people. And this was, you know, as I'm sure, you know, the veteran of the United States Marine Corps on here with us will tell you, I mean, that is an act of war as much as it is some random country killing. And, you know, I think the details about how many people were there matter. I think the fact that this happened in the dead center of the Mississippi Delta matters. What emerges in the telling of the story of this barn is a long history of the land around the barn, a 1,300-year history of 36 square miles in the Mississippi Delta. I mean, one of the smartest things I've ever heard about government came from Mr. Carville, and it was, you know, that one of the roles of government is to take the sharp edges off of capitalism. And you see the sharpest edge of capitalism over and over and over slicing Mississippi into a place that was perfect for extracting wealth through cotton and later soybeans, rice, and corn, and devastating for the people who were making that return on investment. And like all of those stories coalesce into why these people intersected in that barn on that night.
Right. The woman who set this all off and made the charge against Emmett Till recanted her story, sort of. What do you think happened in that grocery store back in 1955?
I think that Emmett Till had just turned 14. He was overweight. He had a stutter. He had come down to Mississippi, and he wasn't able to, like, he was having a hard time working with all of his cousins in the fields, and so that he wasn't going out. And I mean, I imagine that he whistled, trying to show off for the older kids and the other country kids. I think that, you know, Carolyn Bryant's sister-in-law always thought that she made the story up because her husband had been down in Louisiana on a quote-unquote seafood run, which generations of Mississippians have used as an excuse to go down to Louisiana and party. And I think she made up this story to try to convince her husband to never do that again. And, you know, it is bizarre that in 1955, whistling was a capital offense. And, you know, one of the things that I hope the book does is lay out beat by beat how a world was created in which that was possible, and then show you the connections between that world and now. I mean, everybody knows that Emmett went to the store on a Wednesday. What almost nobody knows is that the day before was election day in Mississippi for one of the most rhetorically violent gubernatorial campaigns in the state's history, which is saying something. I mean, we've had some real crazy governor's races in Mississippi, and this one was, you know, probably the most unchecked. It was crazy, the stuff they were saying. And so the state had been whipped up into a frenzy by the five candidates for governor, and you know, it draws a pretty direct line between political rhetoric and violence on the edges of society. And, you know, that feels obviously like a very modern story.
James.
So, right. Let's talk about Mississippi. And there are two events. And, of course, to talk about Mississippi is to talk about race. Same thing as Louisiana. To me, the two biggest racial events were Emmett Till and the Neshoba County, Philadelphia, where they killed this guy. What's also really interesting, there's probably no family that exhibits more Mississippi royalty than the Mannings. And what's really odd is Archie grew up right by the barn, and Olivia grew up in Philadelphia, where they have the Williams store, which is one of the great, if you've never been there, you should. But talk a little bit, tell us, it's not all Mississippi. Where Archie grew up from is different country, different landscape, different origins than where Olivia grew up in the hill country of Mississippi.
So I mean, where
tell a story through them.
So where Olivia grew up is, you know, those Piney Woods. I mean, that's old school KKK territory. I mean, right. You know, you know that area very well. The Neshoba right. County Fair. Someone once called the Neshoba County Fair Republican Woodstock. I wish I'd thought of that. and, you know, Archie is from the dead center of the Delta. I mean, almost the exact geographic center in Drew, Mississippi, which is, you know, the big plantation sharecropper south. South of Memphis, north of Vicksburg. And, you know, it is quite the coincidence that both of them are from there. And researching the book certainly taught me, and I hope people who read it will understand, that's because no one from Mississippi is untouched by it when you start looking around. And everybody's family tree has people on both sides of this fight. I mean, the fight for Mississippi's soul is one that, you know, we've been fighting since 1818 in Mississippi. And you, if you've been in this state long enough, you are going to have people on both sides of it. I mean, you think about, you know, Governor Winter and Ray Mabus and, you know, the politicians who would be unimaginable to be.
Even Thad Cochran, right?
Not even Thad Cochran. I would say especially Thad Cochran.
Yes, you're right.
And, you know, there's a whole generation of Mississippians fighting against equality for all people, and there's been generations of Mississippians fighting for it. And like this is James knows all about that in Louisiana, and it's a fight that I don't know that'll ever be won, and it feels like a pendulum. And you know, it's a little scary where we are right now in the pendulum, but I hope people who read the book will get to the fourth act and see the people who are actively fighting for the better angels of Mississippi and see that there is hope that the pendulum swings back, you know, that this too shall pass.
Yeah, I so agree. None of us here. I grew up in Louisiana on the river, along the river. And what I find interesting about Mississippi is it's not homogeneous. Where I've spent a lot of my time, like Bay St. Louis, Hancock, Harrison County, is entirely different than Neshoba County, which is entirely different than LaFleur County. I mean, it's important that people understand that. It's not one generic, one issue place at all.
No, and there are many different Mississippians, and the Venn diagram overlaps slightly, certainly in that, you know, all conversations, as you said, in Mississippi are about race, but they're also about class. And it is interesting because parts of eastern Mississippi are almost like Alabama and parts of southern Mississippi are almost like Louisiana and parts of southwestern Mississippi are almost like Arkansas. But, I mean, there are many, many different versions of the state. One of the things they have in common, of course, is that the history, you know, Mississippi was essentially founded as a colony of Manchester, Liverpool, London, and New York City. And even though I grew up there and I go back many generations deep there, I didn't realize that for how long, the whole time that cotton was the most important commodity in the world until it got replaced by oil in the mid-1930s, that the global river of capital flowed proudly and powerfully through the state of Mississippi. And so I didn't realize how closely the caste system, that is one of those things that unites the disparate parts of the state, I didn't really understand how that had been born.
Right. You know, I believe this is true. On the eve of the Civil War, Mississippi had more wealth than Virginia.
It was, you know, on the eve of the Civil War, I mean, cotton was oil and Mississippi was Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And we forget that slavery was a good deal for a slave owner. It was a great day.
Can you imagine? You talk about making money. You know, I mean, it's insane. And then the degree to which the entire economy, I mean, it was a little bit of a Ponzi scheme and it collapsed. Like my favorite detail is, I mean, there were a couple of like researching this about the Civil War. One is that the vaunted Confederate generals loved to buy fancy uniforms, but they were unable to nationalize the railroads and have trains show up at the point of battle with 8 pounds of hay a day for every horse and enough food and bullets. And so there was a moment that even as it was happening, the Civil War on the southern side was a reenactment of a military campaign. I mean, they didn't have those majors who graduated from West Point who were nerding out on the slide rules and making sure everything showed up. And my favorite detail is that nobody has less power but thinks they have more power than someone running the last rung on a commodity chain. And so when the Civil War started, the South decided arrogantly and smugly that they weren't going to sell any cotton because that way they would bring Europe to their knees. But like any, you know, my family are cotton farmers. And I mean, I knew almost before I could read and write that the most important thing in the entire world is the carryover. Like how many bales of cotton are in the global textile chain that have not been turned into clothes or whatever. And in 1860, 1859 and 1860 were such huge cotton crops that the South decided to start a civil war when there was so much carryover sitting in warehouses around Europe that nobody really needed any more cotton for 2 years. And so the South started a war because they had politicians who loved giving speeches trying to wind the people up to win votes, but they didn't have anybody who knew shit about economics. And so they started a war that was doomed before they fired the first shot. And so, like, sometimes I wonder, like, why all these monuments around the South don't ever mention that all of these young boys went off to die in a war that their, like, rhetorically aggressive and fiscally stupid leaders sent them to die, where that war was over the moment the 1960 cotton crop left the docks of America to go to Europe. And, like, that was, I didn't know any of that. Obviously, right. In my high school, we studied the genius of Robert E. Lee and the War of Northern Aggression.
I turn back, we were making a point earlier. The one thing, and can't do much about this election, but all this talk of tariffs is not popular in the Mississippi Delta, and it's not popular on the Mississippi coast. Let me tell you,
you know, Donald Trump is catastrophic for the American farmer, both in terms of what he's done and what, you know, the 2025 platform says they want to do. And so, one, I don't think he really understands the degree to which farm subsidies are actually subsidies for American chemical companies and manufacturing companies. But the tariffs, I mean, look, there are smart farm economists who might disagree with me about this, but I'm happy to have this conversation with anybody that, I mean, the tariffs are certainly one of the major factors to blame in the elevation of Brazil's cotton economy from fourth to third in the world, replacing the United States as the number three cotton producer. And the fact that there is now another U.S., India, and American-sized cotton crop flooding in the market. Look, every day I check, the price of cotton right now, the December cotton futures are at 70 cents a pound. And I mean, that's below production cost. And that is, I mean, I would lay that directly at the feet of Donald Trump being an idiot on Twitter.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to pick that up. I want to go back to Emmett Till. If you look at the 60s, the Birmingham church bombing, the killing the civil rights workers in Neshoba, Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they all produced a reckoning, results. People were outraged. Things happened. Bills were passed. For all the tragedy of Emmett Till and his mother insisting on that open casket to show what they'd done to her boy, it really kind of was forgotten, wasn't it? I mean, it was only a year later that the Southern Manifesto was adopted by most of those politicians.
You know, it wasn't exactly forgotten, although many, many parts of it were forgotten, and that forgetting was quite intentional. I would argue they were, in the book argues, they were erased. But I think that that murder created a movement, but it also created the opposition to that movement, both of which remain strong. I mean, in some respects, you know, July 1776 isn't the birth of America. It's August 1955, the modern America that we live in now. I feel like so many of the things that we continue to fight about that, you guys have spent your whole life involved in these fights. I feel like a lot of that was born in this moment, which is another one of the sub-arcs of the book.
Right. My good friend Janet Langhart Cohen did a wonderful play on Emmett Till and Anne Frank talking about bigotry in an afterlife called called memory. But are there other conversations and memorials in Mississippi to Emmett Till? And was that barn sold, and what's being done with it?
So the barn is being purchased by the Hollywood producer Shonda Rhimes, who is a really remarkable person who's put her money where her mouth is over and over and over, but especially here. And there are many other markers, but I mean, the Bryant's Grocery, where the whistling occurred, that is owned by the family of one of the jurors who refuses to sell it, and it is rotting on the Money Road in between Minner City and Greenwood, Mississippi. It's falling down. The National Park Service has just come in and taken over Roberts Temple in Chicago, which is that project is the baby of Wheeler and Marvell Parker, Emmett's family, and the courthouse in Sumner, and the river site in Glendora, Mississippi, which symbolizes where the body was pulled out of the Tallahatchie River. So, like, there is an ongoing thing. There's an ongoing project to remember, just as there has been an ongoing project to forget. And the conflict between those two things is eternal, ongoing, but feels especially freighted with meaning right now.
Well, that leads me to my final question, and this is for you and James, and what the hope is for your native Mississippi. You live in Oxford, an extraordinary town. I'm sure you know my dear friend Curtis Wilkie. But my son worked in a gubernatorial campaign there last year, and they came close, and there were some encouraging signs. But, you know, Mississippi still is one of the few states that has not done Medicaid expansion. There was terrible corruption about money intended for poor people down there, and education, healthcare outcomes for black citizens are probably the worst in America. What are your hopes, though, for your state? And James, jump in.
Well, I'll go, and then I'd like to hear from James, because James probably has a better sense of, I know what my hopes are, and I would love James to tell me what he thinks is possible. Because, you know, I met your son in that campaign. They did a great job. And there were a lot of us who thought that, you know, this was going to be the first Democrat governor since Ray Mabus. And sometimes I worry that we're tilting at windmills. And then other times, through the actions of dedicated people, I believe that that there is a new Mississippi that is populated by one tribe of people who are all Mississippians, and that, you know, Elvis Presley and Muddy Waters are everybody's a member of the same tribe of Mississippians. I don't know, man. It sort of depends on what day you ask me, honestly.
Well, right. I'll talk about this, and Allie, if I can jump in. This Rankin County story about these cops literally make you throw up. If you ever, like, if you want to point, say, well, maybe we can reckon, maybe this is a county right east of Jackson that's really populated, you know, real, what you would think. And they were like killing guys and beating them up. And it was a black guy that lived in the room or something. I have no idea. It was, and they're all going to jail forever, and it should be longer than forever. But did that story shake you up like it shook me up?
That shook me. The the Mississippi corruption scandal shook me, you know, a lot, because, you know, most people don't realize that Mississippi was founded by the Bernie Madoff of the 1700s, a Frenchman named John Law. I mean, there just is corruption baked in. And so when things like that happen, it sometimes feels like the swallows back to Capistrano, like, here we go again. And so it both shook me for how shocking it was, and James, it shook me because it wasn't shocking at all.
Right. It was like, am I supposed to be surprised, or did I really deep down inside? And it's so awful. I don't want to redo the whole thing, but if you're a good citizen and you care about this country, you should read the story, because this happened last year. This shit is not something 1958.
No, and bullshit. Like, and you know, like, Mississippi, Jerry Mitchell is going to be able to write stories forever because there's always some crazy shit happening.
And Mississippi and, Today, that's a great thing for Mississippi.
I know, Mississippi Today is great.
Let me just tell you, Anna Wolf. Anna Wolf, they should put Anna Wolf on money. Like, Anna Wolf is doing, Anna Wolf and Jerry Mitchell to me are the two most important residents of the state of Mississippi. Like, and I mean that.
My wife is doing a piece for Time Magazine on the 100 most influential young women in America, and she's writing it on Anna Wolf. And boy, does she qualify.
Let me tell you.
Right, we got to come back on and talk some more about this, right? Because it's people like a, not like have the same place of sense of place that we do, and sense of hope and disappointment that you do. I mean, you, in one sense, when you live in a place like Mississippi, or you live in a place like Louisiana, sometimes you get your hopes up and then they get crushed, and well, then you try to get them up again.
Okay, I want everybody out there, you know, go to Amazon or go to your local bookstore, even better, and buy The Barn, The Secret History of a Mississippi Murder, The Terrible Emmett Till Story, told by Wright Thompson. Wright, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Thank you, James.
James, in our discussion of the Supreme Court, while I agree that it has certainly been very Republican, not just a conservative court, but unlike you, I thought Chief Justice John Roberts was at least trying to find some common ground. Then there was the outrageous decision giving Trump immunity from some possible crimes he committed. You know, forget the idea that no man is a king. Roberts, an exceedingly well-documented New York Times piece revealed, engineered that decision. You think he and his merry band of Republican justices would have decided that immunity case if it involved Presidents Obama or Biden? No way. There was a unanimous Court of Appeals decision, which included a Republican who had sided with Trump on some other matters, that ruled, of course, he doesn't have special immunity. Almost immediately, the Times reported, Roberts declared he'd reverse that decision. He even took the authorship from Sam Alito, who was caught flying an insurrectionist flag from his home. The Roberts decision was ridiculed by a number of important legal scholars. One smart court watcher said, I'll tell you what the chief is about. He's like little Lindsey Graham. He figures if he can't beat them, he better join them. And that's what he's doing. So the United States Supreme Court, under John Roberts, is taking on the appearance of a MAGA subsidiary. One more point. The press should aggressively now seek out what's going on. Internal deliberations, differences, political and interest group pressure. I'm sorry, if you can cover the Pentagon that way, why the hell can't you cover the Supreme Court? I think particularly when a court is this political, there is a greater need for transparency.
Yeah, I don't think Trump, you know, figured he couldn't find me joining him. Roberts. I think Roberts was always that way. I think he fooled people because he had this kind of demeanor. He went to an Ivy League school. You know, he worked the right people. And there was this assumption that, well, he's a kind of umpire, may not like him, and bullshit. He's been a dedicated right winger his entire goddamn life. His entire judicial philosophy is to keep Democrats from voting, keep companies able to make as much money as they can without any larger public obligation. I mean, some of the stuff that they've done is outrageous. But the narrative that is, I think, the least likely is he got co-opted by these people and just kind of enjoyed having power and put it together. I think he was always one of them. I think he duped a lot of people, really duped a lot of people. I don't think his wife has gotten near enough attention for her previous job or, you know, as I understand it, somebody have to check me out. My understanding is she's a pretty dedicated, longtime pro-lifer. And I don't think he's adjusting to anything. I think this is who this guy always was, who he is, and who he always will be. I think he's a Republican hack. And anybody that tries to take him as anything else misses the point.
Okay. Well, I've come around to your point of view, James, on John Roberts. You've educated me. You've learned me.
This is not, I don't know if it's an outrageous observation. So Melania Trump has a new book, and she's publicized it, and she defends her time, apparently, as a nude model, just going by what Melania Trump says, and that the media and the liberals mocked her, and she thinks that the human body form is something of beauty and blah, blah, blah. I don't think anybody can find where she was mocked by anybody in the liberal media. I think she just made this shit up, or maybe they'll find one story where someone said something. But I think it's like hilarious that she's coming forward and she's this courageous woman who's like showing, pioneering and showing other women how beautiful their bodies are. And as far as I can tell, as of right now, it's all made up. I think it just says a lot insight into how they think or don't think. And I'll give a shit how many nude shots you did. I'm like a crap to me.
You know, I would have people say, Melania may really be different. She may be interesting. Question is, Melania's been married to Donald Trump for 20 years. End of story.
Right. But have you ever heard of, my advice, don't get under too many hot lights because, shit can melt, if you know what I mean.
Okay. We'll be back. We'll be at the 92nd Street Y Thursday night of September 19th, and then Atlanta on the 12th of October and Boston November 2nd. All right, now for the questions from our great listeners. James, boy, they make us think. Jay, in Hershey, Pennsylvania, James wants you to tell him, why are we allowing Donald Trump to continue to brag about the robust economy during his administration without reminding voters that he also created an $8 trillion budget deficit and not nearly as many jobs as the Biden administration?
That's a question I've been getting a lot of texts on that. One of the hard things to do in politics is to try to convince people that they're living in a better economy than they think. And on the good news side, the difference between her and him on the economy is narrowed to, actually, the FT, some posts say voters think that she's better on the economy. I think a lot of the poor economic numbers related to Biden's age. But I do think that we're at a point where we can talk about the risk that Trump presents to the economy. And people are pretty secure in their jobs. The consumer confidence number is up some. This is just a fact. And views on the economy are not static. They're dynamic. They change. And, we talked about this Iowa poll. It was only 4. Agrarian people do not like tariffs. They do not like them at all. They've had bad experience. And if we start talking about the dangers that he exposes this economy to, a risk not we shouldn't take, because people start, I'm sorry, the stock market is up. It just is. I don't care if you feel what you're not. You can feel what you're looking at. I think, the retail sales number was good. You're going to have a Fed cut maybe while we're on this show, while we're taping this show. And people in Washington, Wall Street say, well, that's all priced in. No, the average guy is not priced in the fact that interest rates are getting ready to come down. And that's going to be on the news and everywhere you see.
And for us seniors, James, our IRAs have never looked better.
Right. But we gotta convince people that you have something to risk here. This is not just a way I'm just going to vote something different because I think I got nothing to lose. You got a lot to lose now. You got a lot to lose. You've never had better job security. Your investments, to the extent that you have some, have never done better. And interest rates are getting ready to come down. And you don't want to expose that through tariffs or willy-nilly massive tax cuts to rich people, and that's all his right. economic plan is.
Arthur in Covington, Kentucky says, since Elon Musk put out a type of call for the assassination of Democratic leaders on X, can the U.S. government go after his assets, deport him, or take other action? Didn't really quite do that. He raised a very tasteless and ugly question about why there aren't attempts on Biden or Harris. Elon Musk is a brilliant entrepreneur, incredibly successful. He's really an insidiously dangerous and ugly and weird man, and he's wrecking Twitter. And I'm happy he's with Donald Trump. We don't want him.
Yeah, I don't want to get into picking a fight with a guy worth $200 billion, say the least. He's a different dude. I mean, he's a remarkable engineer. He's obviously built a better mousetrap for now. And that his Taylor Swift comments were, just unbelievable. The guy is obviously pretty impressed with himself.
Well, he is. Peter in New Mexico. James, you're going to love this one. Randall Terry, an anti-abortion activist, is running for president. I didn't know that. On the Constitution Party ticket. And Peter says he's on the ballot in Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin. With Trump struggling to define a position on abortion, would it make sense for some outside Democrats to boost Terry's candidacy to divide the white evangelical vote and erode Trump's support?
I've just spent my time saying Trump said that there has to be penalties for women who get an abortion. We got it on tape. All right. Trump is the reason that we don't have Roe v. Wade anymore. He brags on it. I don't think we should we should convince people that Trump is the worst option you can for people that believe in women's reproductive rights. And I don't think we should tell people there's another one better than him. He's the greatest anti-reproduction right person that ever lived. And I think that's more effective. Now, some of them may, and I've talked about this before, these pro-life people are such mess, the hypocrisy. One thing I used to admire them is they weren't hypocrites. They had something. Now they're in total retreat. And, let this guy be on here, but I don't think we should say there's a better anti-abortion candidate than Donald Trump. He's the greatest anti-abortion candidate that ever lived.
The first week of November will decide the fate of the nation. We always say, it's a cliche, this is the most important election in our lifetime, blah, 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 blah. This one really may be. I think we speak for all of us when I say that James and I are excited to turn the page, and we want to spend part of that week with you. That's why we're taking Politics War Room live to Boston, the cradle of liberty, at the Schubert Theater on November 2. We're going to rally the troops, hear from a special guest, and kick off election week by pre-partying with our listeners with a live show. That's going to be a blast. What about it, James? How much fun is it going to be surrounded by people in Boston, Massachusetts, going into the big day?
I just read a story that Boston is the safest city in the United States. I don't mean to go in and get beat over the head, but it's one of my favorite cities. And, there's so much energy. And, it's a very civic-minded place. And you know people from Boston, you spend time there. And obviously, given the nature of the population and given the nature of all of the universities, probably more universities per capita in Boston anywhere else in the world, it should be enthusiastic and fun crowd. I love Boston. I can't wait.
I feel the same way. I lived there for 2 years when I was young, and I love going back. I love those 2 years. It's the most. I don't think there's a more politically involved place in America. At least it's in the top three or four. I mean, people really care about politics there. They've had a bunch of great politicians. They've had a bunch of characters. I've never seen anything that would be called dull in Boston politics. So it's one of the reasons that we're so happy to be there. And we want everyone listening to join us on the tour during that election's final stretch. All you have to do is go to politicon.com/tour and get your tickets for November 2 at the Schubert Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, don't wait. They're going fast, and we want to see as many of you there as we can. So head to politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. We'll see you there. Trudy from Hawaii says, Kamala spanked Trump during the debate, but the way she answers questions about the Biden economy draws criticism. She's accused of dancing around a real answer. And he says, this will warm your heart. If the great communicator Mitch Landrieu could inhabit her body for a while, how would he answer? You know, you're right, Trudy. I listened to her interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer. It wasn't that it was bad, but she was asked a direct question about the cost of living, and she spent the first minute describing her growing up experience, and her mother was a hard worker and all that. That's fine. She established some of that during the convention. She has an answer. She has to get to it right away, and it basically has to be, look, we're making a lot of improvement, but we got a long way to go, and the one thing I'm going to do, I'm going to make sure that this price gouging doesn't continue. I'm going to make sure that we negotiate prices for prescription drugs. And yes, your cost of living is something that I care about a lot, and it's going to be better if I'm president.
Yeah, I think the better way is to just come out with a couple of little, do I understand that? That's why we have insulin caps. That's why I want to go after people for price rigging, blah, 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 blah. And then say, this is something I'm acutely aware of, and then tell a story of your middle-class origins,
right,
that you work at McDonald's, that you've had some experience with it. But you should have a quick in-and-out kind of answer where you said, of course I thought about this because I've been through it myself. But you can switch the order up a little bit. The other thing that I've talked to some people today, and this is kind of universal, the whole portrayal of Harris and the word that people use in focus groups and a lot is ditzy. So Fox and Newsmax and Trump had built this entire image that she giggled, she wasn't serious, she was ditzy, she was typical female. And of course, the debate came in and blew that whole narrative to smithereens. So then they're stuck, all right? So you, Sean Hannity, you, Jesse Walters, and you're stuck. You got your naked, you're trying to cover your crotch. And well, you said all of this, so therefore we have to go to, she had somebody talking in her ear, it was planted,
gave her
it
the
was
questions,
a rigged deal.
Right.
They gave her the question because they had to have a justification of why the Kamala Harris, we told you, would show up, didn't show up, an entirely different person did. But understand that a lot of the images of her are still formed by that. And I think there's a golden opportunity here because people, the more that they find out about her, the more that they realize their original impressions and impressions that they were told were not correct. And I think there's a good opportunity here.
James Jack in San Rafael, California, says Harris should continue to campaign brilliantly, she has, but Democrats need to stay aggressively in the offensive to keep the Trump campaign on its heels. Where are the Democratic versions of Roger Stone or Steve Bannon, James?
Well, first of all, they're unencumbered by the truth. And when you're unencumbered by the truth, they said, look, the immigrants are eating dogs and cats. And then J.D. Fan said, well, that's not true, but we had to do it to
create a story,
to start
right.
a conversation. Yeah, if you're the problem with Democratic messaging, not all of it, it could be better, is our people don't want to be lied to, theirs do. And if your target message audience likes to be lied to, then you can make up the best stories
right.
in the world.
Right.
We're not even remotely constrained
yeah.
by truth.
Yeah.
And if you know, my favorite is they said, well, the ABC people fact-checked Trump more than they did Harris because he lied more.
they weren't fact-checking him on his opinions. They were fact. I mean, he
right.
said, I created the best economy, you know, in the history of the world. That's not true. But that wasn't. He was fact-checking when he said that, you know, he was basically talking about abortions after birth.
Didn't go,
yeah, which is just, illegal.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Yeah, it's also stupid. Right. Go ahead.
Bruce Next. In Sausalito, California says, with all the funds at the Harris campaign's disposal, shouldn't the Harris team take better advantage of Taylor Swift's endorsement? It's worth noting she's from Pennsylvania. I just got back from Pennsylvania. I have always been very skeptical of celebrity endorsements. I don't think they matter much. You know, maybe they help with some fundraising. I'm not sure that Taylor Swift isn't a little different. I think she reaches younger voters. She reaches suburbanites. And I know at least I talked to a couple really smart Democrats up there. You know, she's not going to be the difference. You know, she's not going to bring you 3 or 4 points. But they think that she really could play a role in turning out some more voters.
Well, I forgot the numbers, but like 500,000 people tried to right after that. The Swifties tried to register. They did something right proactive. My point is, they just didn't sit there, you know, go to concert and cheer and forget about it. She actually stimulated people to do something. And I think that, I don't know much about her music, obviously don't know her. I think that they are so threatened by her because that young person, I guess she's 37, she's young to me, she seems really confident in herself. I mean, she's obviously one of the great entertainers, shit, maybe I'll fucking live for all I know. She's very comfortable. She's confident. And, you know, her boyfriend's obviously like great guy, comes from great families, since say he's a great football player. Everything that you see, I think she really brings out feelings of inadequacy in these right-wing people. I think that's why they hate her, because she's confident, you know, female who's very pleased with her, should be, as she well should be, with her talent and her looks and everything about it. I think these people look at her as a giant threat, because this is a woman that really don't
right, and she's like all that, James, and independent. She didn't go and endorse Kamala Harris after consultations and deliberations with the Harris camp. She did it right at the end of that convention on her own. The Harris people didn't know it was coming, which I think is a testament to her both her independence and probably her savvy, James.
Maybe. I hope so, but there's
anyway,
I know about this woman.
I'm a seniors for Swift. Henry in Louisville, Kentucky. Final question says, why is it never discussed that when a woman has an abortion, there was a man involved? Maybe 90% of the time, a man is fully supportive of that choice. It's not just a woman's issue, right, James?
I completely agree. And by the way, Louisville is one of my favorite places I've ever lived, been to, had anything to do. It's a great town. And, you know, I've said this, that I think that white college males are a place that Democrats can actually got some upside, because white college males tend to be more pro-choice than non-college white males. And also, they have something to lose in this economy. So I think it's a good target audience. And I do. I think it's not just a woman's issue. You know, everybody's got a mother, everybody's got sisters, everybody's got children, everybody knows people and knows the tragedy that this can happen. So I think we're going to surprise sometimes with some better educated white males.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, keep those questions coming in. They are really good. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Remember, get your tickets for the Politics War Room tour. James and I are bringing the podcast to you live on stage at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta on October 12th and Boston's Schubert Theater on November 2nd. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour. That's politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, The Washington Post, Quince, and Smalls, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.